Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It's 12 p.m. and that is Central Time. Today is November 18th, and today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. And I'm recording a little earlier today because I'll be heading to the airport soon to head over to the UK for the chart seminar. So I thought we'd kick off with the total assets of the main central banks. It's currently sitting around 30 trillion. At the beginning of the year, it was a lot closer to 33.5 trillion. So we've had a good sized pullback. And then it popped on the upside over the last month. So it does help to put into perspective what we're looking at here, that this is a total or a summation of all of the assets on central banks, but it's redenominated into dollars. So the dollar has been on a storming rally for most of this year, and it has led to a contraction in the value of assets sitting on central banks around the world. And that has resulted in the index coming down. But what it's also doing in real time is siphoning liquidity out of the global economy. So even though the Federal Reserve's balance sheet really hasn't come down all that much, and other central bank balance sheets haven't really moved at all, then this is just a reflection of exactly what has been going on. Now, let's just think about what's going to happen next. So the Federal Reserve has begun to reduce the size of its balance sheet, and the pace of that runoff is picking up, because they're not just running off the bonds as they mature, but they're also starting to sell some. Now, usually in a runoff, there are two ways that it could happen, because the Federal Reserve owns both treasuries and mortgages. Well, with regular bonds, they could just wait for the maturity and not reinvest the proceeds, and then that takes money out. So that's one way that they could do it, and they're doing that. One of the things that has mitigated the contraction of the balance sheet has been TIPS. So if we look at a TIP bond and then look at that price, well, the price hasn't gone down. It's been basically going sideways. So whenever the inflation rate goes up, well, then what happens is the principal goes up. So what has been happening in terms of the Fed's balance sheet is that its holdings of TIPS have been increasing in value as inflationary pressures have gone up, and that has weighed against the runoff that they were hoping to do with their quantitative tightening program. So when inflationary pressures roll over, then those TIP the principal on the TIPS doesn't go up anymore and has the potential to go down, and that would accelerate the pace of the balance sheet runoff. So that's an important factor. It's likely contributing to the speed with which the size of the Fed's balance sheet is now going down, even though the initial pace seemed to be slower than initially advertised. It is starting to play catch up. So that is contributing to liquidity getting taken out of the system. Now, then let's think about mortgage bonds. Well, one thing that is just an idiosyncrasy of the mortgage bond market is that people prepay, or they repay their mortgages early. So then what that does is it reduces the maturity of some of those bonds. If a sufficient number of the bonds in the pool are redeemed early, well, then that is going to have a material impact on the size of the balance sheet, because you're getting your money back faster. Now, in an environment where you have very high interest rates, well, there aren't going to be a lot of people refinancing their mortgages. And why would one pay back a 3% mortgage when inflation is running at 7%? You're basically robbing yourself. That you're basically getting money for free if you are only paying 3% on a loan, and the inflation rate is running at 7%. So there isn't going to be a lot of prepayments when you have that environment. It's incentivizing people to just sit tight. So in order to reduce the size of their mortgage portfolio, they would actually have to sell those mortgages. That would only increase the yield and make the prepayments issue even worse. So that would suggest that the majority of the selling pressure will come from the treasury markets. Now let's think about what that means for the dollar. So the dollar did do exceptionally well this year as yields rose. Now the 10-year yield has bounced, so that is lending some support to the US dollar. And the 10-year yield is up the last 2 days. Considering that it contracted by about 50 basis points in a very short period of time, I think it is quite likely that the yield is going to push back up towards 4% and then probably roll over again. Perhaps the most important thing right now is if we look at the yield curve, because we have a sharply inverted yield curve where the 10-year is currently sitting at about 3.8%, and you can get a 1 month maturity at 3.74. Well, why on earth would you invest money with the US government for 10 years at 3.8% when you can give up 7 basis points and get your money back with a return in a month? So that's going to shove a lot of resources into the short end of the curve. But the whole business model of the banking sector is about lending on the long end, borrowing at the short end. So, in an inverted yield curve scenario, where every maturity all the way out to 7 years is higher than the 10-year, well, what that's going to do is artificially depress yields at the low end. And even then, we have an inverted yield curve. If we simply look at the difference between the 10-year and the 3-month, there's no incentive to own those 10 years. So their yield is rising relative to the 3-month. And we have a very sharply inverted environment. So it's now down to the lows it was at in 2019. Now, I think everyone will be very aware of the fact that the Federal Reserve was very clear in stating that this was the yield curve spread to watch, and that was back when it was trading over 200 basis points earlier this year. That's a little bit of a shuffle from the Federal Reserve. They simply took the data point that fit their narrative. Because if we look at the 10-year minus the 2-year, well, then it peaked in early 2021. Earlier this year, it was just about, it just had inverted and bounced. Now we're down to negative 69 basis points. The last time we had an inverted yield curve like this was around the time of the savings and loan crisis in the early 1980s. So it's not that surprising that we should have some kind of liquidity issues starting to pop up. We saw that with the pension system in the UK. They were engaged in egregiously risk-on behavior, where they were basically levered on the assumption that the yields on the long end would never rise. So that has resulted in a really major issue and a significant loss for those pensions. Then we have the issues that are going on right now in the cryptocurrency world. And investors are getting out of any kind of Bitcoin exchange at present. And this is a very difficult environment because investors know that Bitcoin tends to have these Bitcoin winters. And therefore, nobody wants to be seen to be the one that's selling right at the bottom. But then you have the fact that rehypothecation is something that happens or definitely happened with abandon in the cryptocurrency world. So what that basically means is that companies like FTX were taking in money, lending it out, and potentially lending it out to multiple people or lending the same coin out to multiple people. And then when those investments went bad, then it revealed a huge hole on their balance sheets. So now the big question is, are companies like Coinbase, are they going to be accused of the same thing? Now, they might not be. And they might be running a tight ship. They might be very clear in stating that they don't do that kind of thing. But investors right now are in a sort of a show me mood. So that's going to put downward pressure here as well. And it's also very much representative of the wider environment where investors are worried about liquidity issues. And that's, I think, rather relevant. You have the Federal Reserve raising interest rates aggressively, engaged in quantitative tightening. And there's been a lot of speculation over the last few weeks about whether we're approaching the peak of the interest rate cycle. And will we then have a return to very low interest rates? And the reality is that during a recession, central banks cut interest rates because they become more worried about deflation than inflation. But they are still worried about inflation. Inflationary pressures are still very high. And you have the ECB, or Christine Lagarde, speaking today and saying in no uncertain terms that they have to look at their mandate and get inflation back down to a reasonable level. Well, the ECB has only really got one mandate. Now, they haven't really been doing anything about it for most of the last decade. They've been concerned with other things, like huge spreads on the regional debt, and they've been worried about bad loans in the banks, and they've taken over regulation of the banking sector. But they actually only have one official mandate, which is to control inflation and to achieve a target less than 2%. And they're miles away from that right now. So the ECB has to start reducing the size of its balance sheet. And what they've started doing is calling in their loans. So the TLTRO program was a bunch of money that was sent out into the European economy and into the banks so they could lend it out and ensure economic activity proceeded during the pandemic. Now they're starting to call that back in. Well, the banking sector is starting to do better in Europe. And that's not only because of higher interest rates, but also because the euro has started to do better. So the euro is now right in the region of the 200-day moving average. And it's pausing in here today, but it has very clearly broken the downtrend that's been in place now for about 19 months. And I think one of the more important things to pay attention to is the difference between the, let me see if I can pull up this ticker, between the US 10-year. I never really understood until quite recently how much I depend on Bloomberg's predictive texting. But what we can see clearly is if we take the difference in the bond yield between the 2-year and in Europe and the USA, the spread rocketed higher from late 2021 until the middle of this year. That coincided with a really significant move in the dollar. So then what we have is this other environment where this chart looks like it's topping. And if that's the case, well, that would suggest then that the euro is probably going to bottom, because the interest rate differential is really the only hard fundamental. So if the ECB plays catch up with raising interest rates, then the primary support for the dollar will be eroded. So then it's going to start coming down to fiscal issues. Is the European Union going to be more tight on fiscal spending than the USA? Well, now that there's a divided government in the USA, it would suggest that there won't be any additional new spending measures, and that might be a support for the dollar. And we certainly had a rebound in here today. So that's also contributing to some of the reason why the euro hasn't been able to push up through the 200-day moving average. So we're certainly in an environment which is quite alien to everything we've had for the last 20 years. Until really the pandemic, it was easy to make the argument that we were in a currency war, and there was no country wanted a strong currency. And it was really only a question of who needed a weaker currency more than everyone else. But global inflation turns that on its head. And now what we have is competitive currency appreciation, where every country wants to try and mitigate their inflationary pressures. So they're trying to do what's necessary to control spending, and then to support their currency to make imports less competitive. And then, of course, also to try and reduce the cost of energy. So inflation has been the animating force for the last year. But I believe that inflation is peaking now, and it will come down faster than investors are willing to give credence to. The simple fact is that balance sheet runoff by central banks has been tried twice. So you had the ECB taking $1 trillion out of circulation between 2012 and 2014, and by the time they had finished in 2014, there were major fears about the deflation that was gripping the European Union. So they had to react, and they doubled the size of their balance sheet. They were worried about deflation in 2020, and they doubled the size of their balance sheet. So there are a couple of different ways of looking at this. The first is that when they do quantitative tightening, it means that bond yields will go down because you're going to have deflation taking over in terms of investor psychology. And it doesn't happen right away. We can see that it took about 2 years for deflationary fears to really reach their zenith. Then we can think about the size of the Fed's balance sheet. Well, when they took $750 billion out of circulation in 2018, well, we had an inverted yield curve in 2019. It was already a really racy time in terms of company valuations, and particularly valuations within the private sector. And it was looking likely that we were going to have a recession by the time we got to 2020. And then we had the pandemic, and both the response to that tighter liquidity and the size of the assistance really spurred asset prices to significant new highs. But the reality is that the size of the Fed's balance sheet is now contracting. It's quantitative tightening. What we saw in 2018 was that at the beginning of the quantitative tightening cycle, yields went up. And they go up because investors are worried about the fact that central bank selling is crowding out the market. So then there's a surfeit of additional bonds, and yields go up as the market struggles to try and contain them. But then deflationary forces take hold, and bond yields really fell fast in 2019. And then, of course, they collapsed in the during the pandemic. So, yes, we have short-term potential here that yields will rise, and this is going to be a buy-the-dip scenario for bond markets because quantitative tightening will contribute to deflationary forces. Now, I know that there are lots of seasoned economists will argue that monetarism is out of date and that it doesn't stand up to scrutiny over the long term. But when we're talking about money supply growth that has been on an epic scale all the way through the pandemic and its ending, I think it is reasonable to anticipate that the inflation and the massive fiscal transfers that accompanied it on this occasion, well, they've contributed to the inflation, and removing that assistance is going to contribute to deflation. So I think what we have to be surprised for or prepared for is the surprise that bond yields are going to contract faster than investors are really willing to accept. Now, when we think about money supply, well, the sector that has done best from low interest rates and high growth and the ability to profit in an enormous fashion from the rollout of 4G were the Fangman companies. And what I find especially interesting right now is that you have companies like Amazon that were spending $5 billion a year on just Alexa, the smart speaker system. Well, those science projects are over. And Amazon continues to encounter resistance at the $100 level, and this is a consistent downtrend. Then Facebook had, or Meta, they've had to fire 11,000 people. The share is down in an exceptionally dynamic manner. There are major headlines in publications like The Atlantic talking about the end or the death of social media. Well, I talk to my kids about it. I mean, they still use Instagram. I know that my eldest daughter, she deleted her Twitter and Instagram apps from her phone heading into this school year because she wanted to try and improve her grades before she starts applying to college next year. So, at least there's an awareness among the younger generation that these social media apps occupy a huge amount of time. But the reality is that people certainly are still engaging in social media, but that the spending patterns of these companies are going to have to be addressed. Investors also appear to be losing patience with Alphabet, and the share paused in the region of the 1,000-day moving average in here this week. So, Alphabet, more than any other company, has been spending a ton of money on its science projects, with everything from quantum computing to self-driving vehicles, really making headlines and getting everybody excited. Now, the question of are investors going to tolerate that degree of spending when liquidity is tightening up and interest rates rising. This is a great example of how zero interest rates mean that the duration on a portfolio basically goes to infinity. So then when you talk about growth opportunities, you don't have to worry about what the delivery is going to be a year from now or 6 months from now. They had plenty of leeway to talk about how things are going to be a decade from now or longer. And then when you get interest rates rising, well, then you start to see the wings getting clipped and some of those valuations starting to come back down. Now, if we look at the performance of just those eight companies and relative to the total market cap of the entire US market, we had a good sized rally following the initial breakdown, but this is a completing top formation, and there is clear potential that this index of 8 shares is no longer going to represent 20% of the total market and could easily fall relative to the wider market. And of course, this is problematic for the major indices. Now, the S&P 500 is hovering here in the region of the 200-day moving average. And from peak to trough, it was down 27% from earlier this year. So we've had a good-sized short covering rally over the course of the last while. And the big question then is, what happens next? Well, if we get additional interest rate hikes and liquidity continues to be siphoned out of the market, I think it is reasonable to anticipate that we're then also going to see stock markets moving into a more volatile environment. We also know that a recession is more likely than not when you have these incredibly inverted yield curves. Now, I posted a report today or earlier this week from Bridgewater, and they make a solid case for the progression of a bear market. So first you get the interest rate hikes and you get a response to that because people worry about inflation, they worry about the what the future holds. But then you get the second stage where you start getting liquidity issues coming up. Well, we're starting to see liquidity issues coming up now. So we talked about what's happening in the crypto world, and we talked about what's happened in the UK pension markets. But there is another, and it's that the issuers of perpetual bonds have been refusing to buy them back or to at the first call date. Usually, people will buy a perpetual not because they think they're going to be perpetual, but because they offer a somewhat higher yield. And those yields tend to ratchet up over time if the company doesn't buy it back at the call expiration dates. So, usually, the company will try and buy it back, but they're not doing that now because of the cost of capital. That a lot of these perpetuals would have been issued at lower rates, and even with the ratcheting up of the coupon, they're not going to be it's not attractive for the company to buy them back. So that's messing with the duration of bond portfolios, and it's becoming problematic for bond investors. And again, this is also contributing to liquidity issues. If you have been receiving your coupons and you were banking on receiving your principal back within the next 3 months, and now you're being told that it will be a few years and potentially longer, well, then that creates a big headache for bond investors. So these are definitely the signs of the second stage of a bear market. But the third stage of a bear market is where earnings roll over. And tighter liquidity conditions are certainly contributing to that. And we know that credit card debt has been ramping higher. And there's a good reason why credit card debt has been ramping higher. It's simple enough. If the way that people get money is from working, then that's normal. If they want more money, then they can take out an equity release loan from their home. But if interest rates are, if they don't have, if excuse me, that also implies a refinancing. So if they're not refinancing because the mortgage rates are unattractive, well then that reduces liquidity in the system too. So if you do want to sustain your lifestyle and you want to ensure you have plenty of cash to continue spending, well then you put it on your credit card. So credit card spending is ramping higher. Then what happens when you lose your job? Well, unemployment is still exceptionally low, and we still have a large number of open jobs. And I don't believe that the number of open jobs is anywhere close to 10 million, but we do have the reality that unemployment is low, that large numbers of older people have left the workforce, and that there has been a lot fewer, I guess, highly skilled immigrants. So there is a mismatch between the number of available workers and the number of available jobs. But ultimately, as companies start to ease back on their expansion, and we know that demand in the economy is starting to roll over, when we think about the container numbers, so this was a very good indicator of just how tight supply chains were in 2020 and 2021. Well, the price of a 40-foot box has contracted meaningfully, and we're now back to what might have been considered reasonably normal. But then let's think about the dirty tanker index. So this is basically oil tankers, and it is now at highs we haven't seen in quite some time. So we're still in a difficult environment for the oil sector, and it would be very tempting to think that this is because of a big supply shortage, but I don't buy it. I think that a lot of the reason why supply growth has moderated in the shale areas is because of a lack of investment. Shale and unconventional oil and gas are exceptionally capital intensive. So, if you don't have a lot of money flowing into drilling new wells, then supply will start to roll over. But the reason why the dirty tanker index is ramping higher is because of the impending price limitation on Russian oil. Now, Russia seems to be, I would say at least, very unlikely to accept this imposition of a price cap. And we're already seeing that there's a migration underway of the major tankers that are old. So old tankers are migrating to the Russian market because the insurance rule that is being introduced, well, that is going to necessitate that if you decide to use your tanker to take Russian oil, you won't be able to insure it ever again, even if you stop using it for carrying Russian oil. You won't be able to use it, or you won't be able to insure it again. Well, ships generally get scrapped because they are unable to meet the requirements of insurance companies any longer. And there have been plenty of articles over the last few weeks about how governments are paying these absurd storage fees for impounded yachts from Russian oligarchs. And if we think about just what that costs to maintain a vessel in a hostile environment like the ocean, then if they can't get insurance, but they are being paid to carry oil by the Russian government, well, why would they invest in upkeep? It suggests that what we're looking at potentially is, and it might not happen immediately, but a couple of years from now, there's going to be a major oil tanker spillage as a result of the unintended consequences from this event. So it's going to create dislocations in the oil markets. And oil prices right now are falling, and they broke down through the $90 area yesterday and extended the move in here today. And I suspect that what we're seeing now is a reversion back down towards the 1,000-day moving average, which would take prices down to about $80. And that's the upper side of the range that proceeded between 2015 and 21. But then it opens up the potential for future volatility. So oil demand growth is has always been considered to be a constant, and then the supply growth would vary around it. But during recessions, oil demand growth falls, and then it leaves a lot of the supply that's available stranded. And recessions are inevitable because central banks are trying to bring the inflation problem under control. But then we have to start thinking about what happens after that. So there was a clear willingness by investors prior to this year to think that central banks can't raise interest rates because of the size of the debt and the knock-on effect that that has on servicing the debts. And for example, the USA now is spending $500 billion a year on interest expense, and that has gone up materially over the course of the last 2 years. So just how long they can continue to raise interest rates for was really questioned a year ago. Well, then the Federal Reserve raised rates by 300 basis points in less than 6 months. So it clearly demonstrated that they can raise rates fast. But that doesn't detract from the fact that there is a significant lag between raising interest rates and when it has an impact on the stock market. So, well, I kind of think of it like a tidal wave. We know that the during a tidal wave, what happens is that the water gets sucked out first, and then the big wave arrives. So the impact from all this tightening is going to become clear over the next 6 months. It takes about 6 to 9 months for the impact to be felt. So they started raising rates in March. It means that by the time we get to the middle of 2023, the deflationary impact of all of this tightening is going to start to be felt. And then we'll start to see the third stage of this bear market, where corporate earnings roll over. So corporate earnings projections have started to be brought back in. Now, one thing that I think is especially important right now is that this is a slightly different market environment than we've ever had in the past. So it's normal in the latter stages of a big bull market for the energy sector to do really well. And that's happening now. And a lot of that is because we've had less investment in new supply. And it's been because global economic growth was really boosted by all of the money printed over the last few years. So the oil sector has been the best performing stock market sector for 2 years in a row. And it's still right in the region of the all-time peaks. Well, in a recession, that's not going to last. The materials sector tends to do exceptionally well in the final stages of a big bull market. And the materials sector has rallied really impressively over the last few years, but it is now encountering resistance at the lower side of the overhead trading range. So, in a recessionary environment, the best performers prior to the recession are unlikely to be the ones that do best when the recession hits. That would suggest that there is quite significant room for a rotation to take place at some point over the next 3 months, and that we'll start to see the kinds of companies that do well in a less high growth environment moving to outperformance. Well, that would suggest that the consumer staples will probably be the last sector to roll over. Then let's think about what happens afterwards. Well, if we move into a recession, and then what will central banks do? Now we can think about what's China doing right now. So they used the opportunity of the pandemic to squeeze the property sector and certainly exert more control over the population. And they did not spend nearly the same amount of money, but they are looking at somewhat weaker economic growth, less consumer activity because everyone's been locked up in their houses, and a big hit to consumer confidence because property prices are going down. So China's looking at least what looks like a recession from a Chinese perspective. So what they're doing now is they're making more money available through the banking sector. They're reducing some of the very onerous COVID restrictions, and they're trying to support the property market, and the credit impulse is pushing back higher. Now, if we look into a recession in the USA and in Europe and much of the rest of the world, well, we can anticipate that they are going to cut interest rates, but they won't do so until there's a real deflationary threat. And a deflationary threat would accompany corporate profits rolling over. So that would be the third and final stage of a bear market. Then you get the monetary accommodation coming in, and there'll be a substantial rebound in risk assets. So we would have to think then about what's the timing look like for that kind of scenario. Well, we know that there is a 6 to 9 month, maybe even a 12 month lead in terms of monetary tightening and when it has an impact on markets or on the economy, excuse me. Well, that would suggest that the middle of 2023 will probably see corporate profits rolling over, and then we'll start to see pressure on central banks to begin cutting interest rates. Well, then we're also likely to see stock markets have a difficult time in the first half of the year because the thing that has sustained prices has been the resilience of corporate profits. But if earnings roll over, then that's not going to be as convincing. So then what we get is additional weakness in stocks, a big move in terms of supports from central banks that will put a low in. So then, of course, the big question is going to be, will we see the same kind of central bank response to the impending recession as we've seen from other recessions? In other words, are we going to see the size of the Fed's balance sheet double? In other words, it hit a peak of 9 trillion. Are we looking at 18 trillion as being the size of the Fed's balance sheet in response to the next recession? So obviously, we've had a big inflationary scare. And what I suspect is more likely is we're not going to have the same size of assistance, and that we're not going back down to the zero bound, but rather we'll probably see interest rates fall by about 300 or even 400 basis points. So then let's just think about what that looks like. That the Federal Reserve is now at 4%. They're likely to be at 5 or 5.25% by the time we get to the middle of next year. They're unlikely to start cutting immediately. And we can think about in 2018 and 19, it was about 3 months. In 2007, all the way through to when they started cutting in 2000 or 2006 and 7, it was 14 months. So I think at least a 3 or 4 month interval between when they have finished raising rates and when they decide to start cutting is to be expected. And then when they start cutting, I think that it's likely they'll cut at least 400 basis points. And that would probably take us down to somewhere around 1%. And that will be a really significant tailwind for risk assets. And a lot of the really oversold technology companies, those that actually have earnings growth, will then thrive. Will also start to look at the potential for interest to return to the cryptocurrency sector. What I find especially interesting is this uncanny correlation between the halving cycle and the bottoming of the major bottoms in Bitcoin have generally occurred around the orange period, which means that the number of days until the next halving is less than a year. That's when we get the bottom. Then we often also see that prices dip around the time of the halving, but then the halving itself, it heightens concentration on the limited supply argument, and it tends to coincide with a massive move in the supply of new money. Well, the next halving is in April of 2024. So we're probably going to see Bitcoin bottom out at some point in the next 3 months. And Bitcoin prices are now less consistent than they were in the past. And the price is now below the peak set in 2017. So that's a major inconsistency. Bitcoin has never done that before. It's never pulled back below a previous major peak. What that says to me, at least, is that the peak around 70,000 is unlikely to be superseded, and that we will see a really significant jump in Bitcoin prices during the next easing phase. But if we don't see a doubling in the size of the Fed and other central bank balance sheets, then we're not going to see the same kind of stellar performance by Bitcoin either. They are very much linked at the hip. And if we then think about alternative assets, well, gold prices rebounded in a really emphatic fashion when the dollar was easing. So the dollar steadying up a little over the last few days has contributed to both gold and the euro finding support in the region, or excuse me, encountering resistance in the region of the 200-day moving average. And I think that we're likely to see some additional consolidation, and not least because the bond yields are starting to push higher. But when those bond yields roll over and deflationary forces become more active, then gold is going to rebound. And this big upper dynamic we saw last week suggests more than short-term support in the region of $1,600 and the clear potential that the gold price will exceed the $2,000 level at some point next year as deflation starts to triumph over the current issues with inflation. And then let's just think about gold in terms of purchasing power parity, because I think it's especially interesting that gold prices peaked in 2011, right around the same level that they peaked in purchasing power parity terms in 1980. Then they got up to test it again in 2020 and pulled back. And now we're looking at a higher reaction low. So this potentially is the low in gold. And when gold prices go up again, they will both exceed the $2,000 level, but then also exceed the purchasing power parity peaks from 2011 and 1980. And that really will begin to suggest that the purchasing power of fiat currencies is under significant pressure, and that the issues with the fiscal situation, where we are now in a major generational shift between the wealth holders who are older and the larger numbers of middle-aged people, that there simply are not enough of workers to pay the kinds of pension benefits that have been promised. Well, the easy way to do that will be to print more money. And then how long is it going to be before the acute link between our what's often referred to as the triple lock will eventually be abandoned between inflation and increases in the pension? Or will taxes on pensions increase commensurately with the inability to continue to fund them, which would of course reduce the burden on the state? These are all in the future, and devaluing the currency in order to deal with occasional crises is going to contribute to continued strength in gold. And then, of course, it's also going to support the emerging markets. Now, the emerging markets ETF is heavily weighted by China, so it has rebounded quite impressively over the course of the last 3 weeks in line with the China markets. But India has a massive young population. So the Nifty index has completely sidestepped the trouble in global stock markets. Singapore's market has also outperformed this year, and as of it's being basically rewarded by its focus on wealth management, and certainly the flow of additional cash away from geopolitical hotspots and into places like Singapore have certainly helped to support the market. And of course, it's been ranging now for more than a decade. So this is also a big range, and we know that ranges are explosions waiting to happen. So in a recovery scenario, the movement of cash towards the favorable demographics and higher growth rates of Asia, and particularly as manufacturing capacity migrates away from a higher cost China, that's likely to be a significant tailwind for tailored investments in emerging markets rather than looking at the wider index, which is very dominated by China. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend. And I'll wish all the best to all of you.